Now it's Mike Slater.
Good morning, Slater Crusaders. America's the greatest country in the world. San Diego's America's finest city. What day is it today? Wednesday. It's Wednesday. Happy Wednesday. Thanks for being here. So yesterday, talked with Harold Rode. If you heard Mary at the bottom of this hour, I apologize for getting sidetracked with our friend Mary. She was just mortified, terribly offended at the suggestion that Persian culture is different than American culture. Just couldn't. How dare you? That we have different values and that our histories have shaped our cultures today. She couldn't accept that. And I feel like I was taken for a ride yesterday for 10 minutes of our conversation, taken for a ride of deceit. Because that was Harold's whole point, is the deceit that Iranians use in negotiation. They use deceit as a tool, and Mary wouldn't accept that, and then I think deceived me in her arguments against it. The term is Kitman. I'm not pronouncing it nearly right, but it's K-I-T-M-A-N or K-E-T-M-A-N. And it's a term from ancient Persia, long time ago. There was a French diplomat in Tehran in the mid-1800s. And he made the argument, not Harold Rode, right? And Mary was very offended that we'd have a Jewish person talk about this. Well, it's a French guy. Okay. He made the argument that because Arabs took over what is now Iran, the Iranians needed to survive and still maintain their own culture, right? They didn't want to be taken over, but they really had no choice. So if they were going to be taken over, they're going to do it on their own terms. So they did what needed to be done and said what needed to be said in order to survive. And they were successful. They survived. So here's what he wrote. Again, this is French diplomat in the mid-1800s. He said, there are occasions when silence no longer suffices. When it may pass as an avow, as an agreement, right? So if you don't say anything, so the Iranians get taken over by Arabs. If you say nothing, then that's going to come across as an agreement, right? So there's going to be situations where you can't just be silent. He says, then one must not hesitate. Not only must one deny one's true opinion, but one is commanded to resort to all ruses in order to deceive one's adversary. One makes all the protestations of faith that can please him, the enemy. One performs all the rites one recognizes to be the most vain. One falsifies one's own books. One exhausts all possible means of deceit to survive. It's because they're being taken over and there's no other choice, they thought, other than deceive, and it worked. And knowing their history, that makes sense. And I feel like that was used against me yesterday on the radio with Mary. I know we've talked a lot in this segment here about Iran and about this deal. But I think it's important to know the full story. And to not be silent and not just go along with what we're told. And we're told it's a great deal, momentous deal, historical deal. This is not true. Can't possibly believe that. Let's break down a couple things real quick. This is an analysis from Amir Tahiri, who is from Iran, Mary. So he has the ability to look at the English agreement, so what the White House puts out, and to look at the Iranian agreement, which is written in Persian. So a couple things here, a couple differences that are important to note. The Iranian text is labeled as a press statement only, which is very different than an official document. The American text, the White House text, is labeled parameters for a joint comprehensive plan of action. Right? See how American that is? Right? Joint comprehensive plan. It's a plan of action. very official, very formal, very let's get after this, very almost final, right? Here are the parameters for the, not there. This it's nothing. It's a press statement. The Iranians have decided nothing. They have no concept of that. Their press releases, it's just general background things for the press to note. Nothing like our leaders are pretending this agreement is. So that's number one. Second, there's different tools in the Persian language that we don't have in America. Ancient languages are very different than what we have. You know, if you study ancient Greek, Latin, I know in Latin you can have a word mean very different things. They can mean, the same word can mean totally opposite things. In Greek, you can have multiple words mean the exact same thing. And also in these languages, there's different tenses, different verb tenses. So in Persian, there's a verb tense called nakara. And it's very passive. It's like a super passive verb tense. We don't really have it in America. It's where the authorship of the act remains super vague. So it's a verb tense like, this is to be done. So I'm trying to think of an example like in English. It doesn't work. We don't talk like that. It'd be like, Charlie, are you going to fill out the TPS report by 5? And Charlie responds, it has happened that this thing is to be done. So it's like, huh? What? They have that verb tense. We don't. The verb tense is it then happened that. See how passive that is? Like, well, who did what? Oh, yes, it then happened that. Who? Who did what? And then in the future passive, it's like, this is to be done. By whom? They don't say. It just will sort of happen on its own. I know that's confusing, and that's the point. It is confusing. So nakara is that verb tense, and then I don't know how to pronounce this, merfa, M-A-E-R-F-A-H. That's a verb tense where you know exactly who is doing the thing. So how does this relate? On the Iranian side, in their agreement, they say the nuclear facilities at Fordow shall be developed into a center for nuclear research and advanced physics. Right, so there's nothing about who's going to do that thing, over what length of time, when, how, like there's no details. It's all like, oh, shall be in the future. Like what, you know, maybe in future time, it shall be done that this will happen, huh? Meanwhile, the Iranian deal says about us, quote, the United Nations shall abrogate its previous resolution while the United States and the European Union will immediately lift sanctions imposed on financial, banking, insurance, investment, and all other services related to oil, gas, petrochemicals, and the car industry. Very specific. Their term is vague, and it's undefined, and it's not clear who's going to be doing what exactly. But when they have an argument that is about what America is going to do, well, you're going to lift sanctions immediately on this, by this time, in this way. Third point. The Iranian agreement opens up by saying there's no legal aspect to the text. But the American agreement says that Iran has agreed to do these things, like reduce the number of centrifuges from 19,000 to 6,000. But they don't recognize that. We say the Iranians have to reduce centrifuges from 19,000 to 6,000. And the Iranian deal says Iran shall be able to reduce centrifuges. Okay, let's sit on this for one second. This is a clear example. The White House statement says, Iran will reduce centrifuges from 19,000 to 6,000. The Iranian deal says, Iran shall be able to reduce centrifuges from 19,000 to 6,000. Shall be able to is very different than will. You see? See how wishy-washy that is? See how vague, nondescript that is? Shall be able to? That means that, you know, shall be able to if we want to. Which is nothing. If I asked producer Miles to do something, let's say Miles agreed to go to the city council meeting on Tuesday. And Miles says, no, I didn't. I agreed that I shall be able to go to the city council meeting if I so wished to, but not that I actually would. I didn't agree that I would. I just said that I shall be able to, but I didn't want to, so I didn't. You can't work like that. That doesn't make any sense. We don't operate that way. Now, maybe that's too subtle. Too subtle to understand. How about this one? There's some more striking differences between the two deals. I should say it's the same deal. It's just different interpretations of the same deal. So the American statement says that Iran agreed not to use advanced centrifuges. The Iranian text says, quote, on the basis of solutions found, work on advanced centrifuges shall continue on the basis of a 10-year plan, meaning they're going to continue using advanced centrifuges. So we say, oh, Iran has agreed to not use them. And Iran is saying, we're still going to use them and we're going to continue to use them. They're totally opposite. The American text says that Iran has agreed to dismantle the core of one of their nuclear plants. And the Iranian text says the plant shall remain open and be updated and modernized. Those are opposite things. The American statement says that Iran is going to do these things in 10, 15, and 25-year increments. The Iranian text doesn't have any numbers in it at all. We are being told complete lies about what was agreed to, because nothing was agreed to. But they have to come out and say something was agreed to, even though very clearly, from Iranian's perspective, nothing was agreed to. It is fantasy to pay attention to our side. It is fantasy to listen to Joe Biden and Barack Obama tell us about the Iranian nuclear deal and John Kerry. There is no deal. The only worthwhile interpretation of the deal is what Iran think they signed. And it's very clear that they think they signed no deal. And anything they did agree to are the things they want to keep doing. I let me be honest. I haven't had a chance to listen to a lot of radio or TV or really anything lately because we've been doing double shows. So I've been just super focused. I haven't heard anyone talk about the deal from the Iranians' perspective. So help me out. Let me know what I'm missing. Let me know if other people are saying these things. Let me know if this is. I don't want to beat a dead horse. I feel like no one's saying this. So I just want to make sure we're all on the same page that there is no deal from the Iranian side. 1-800-760-KFMB, 1-800-760-5362. And I hope other people in the media are saying this. I hope they're breaking down these details. Because if you don't, you're going to believe what we're told. Why would you not? But once you know these details, if the president's not telling us these things, right? If the Secretary of State's not being honest with us on how the differences between the bills or the agreements and how language is different and the difficulties of finding an agreement with the Iran, if they're not telling us these things, then you know they're deceiving us. Just the same as they're being deceived. 1-800-760-KFMB. Mike Slater Show. Spread the word. Slater Presenters will change gears just a little bit. Change topics, but same gear, different topic, if that makes sense. Because we always like to dive a little deeper into what's going on in the news. Get a little deeper understanding, not just play the drive-by game. And I don't think we can get a deeper understanding unless we go back to the beginning. That's what we did yesterday in the last segment with Iran And I want to do that again with water here. And there's no one who can do a better job of that than Peter Hill from PERC, which is the Property and Environmental Research Center. Fantastic organization. The first group, the best, dedicated to improving the environment through property rights and markets, which is the only correct, moral, and effective way of actually improving the environment. Mr. Hill, how are you, sir?
Doing well.
Good. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Before we get to the history of government controlling water, and we'll get to some solutions as well, some specific success stories. But can we talk about your book for just a second, The Not-So-Wild Wild West?
Certainly.
We have this, I like to break paradigms here, so I think you can do that for us. We have this Blazing Saddles, shoot 'em up view of the Wild Wild West from the movies, but you're saying that's not how that worked.
Right. The West basically was pretty orderly, and it was pretty orderly because people on the ground found ways to come up with rules to govern social interactions. So rather than shooting each other, most of the time they agreed that they could come up with local sorts of institutions and local rules that would solve problems of trailing cattle from Texas to Montana, or mining gold in the Sierras, or all sorts of issues like that, solving problems on the open range, and even water. And water had to develop a different framework in California and other places because water was scarce, but it was done by kind of bottom-up, on-the-ground sorts of rules.
Yeah, but Peter, that is not a very exciting movie.
Right.
That's a very boring Western movie. Orderly rules.
It's all about cooperation rather than conflict. But it's interesting because human cooperation, people deciding how to cooperate, I think is an amazing sort of story, but it does require certain sorts of things. It requires well-defined and enforced property rights, and then markets that allow those property rights to be transferred.
Well, let's bring water into this today. So, you told a story. I read a story of yours. The original frontier coming out here in the mid 1800s, there was no government to organize irrigation systems. Yet the people figured out anyway. Specifically, the Mormons. What did they do?
Basically, they figured out that they could irrigate and that they set up local rules to do that, and that worked pretty well by using local institutions to try to move water around. And then, of course, the big change came when gold was discovered in California in 1848. Water originally was kind of, in a sense, owned by people or who could use the water along the stream banks. But with the discovery of gold, it meant that water was valuable if it could be diverted, and so the rules changed to allow that.
Who changed the rules, and how did they change?
Basically, the miners changed them just on the ground because they said, look, you know, it's they first started mining just the sandbars once gold was discovered at Sutter's Mill, but then it made sense to try to be able to get more access to the stream beds themselves, and sometimes they dammed up a portion of the river. Other times they diverted the water to bring it back in on sluice boxes, but that meant that you had to have some sort of a system that decided if you diverted water, who owned it, could it be transferred, how much did you have, all of those sorts of things. And so this gets into a bit of legal history, but it's what we call the doctrine of prior appropriation, that people could establish rights to water by diverting it, and there's a well-established system that the miners came up with. It was basically codified by the California legislature later, and it was also adopted in most of the other Western states.
Doctrine of prior appropriation.
Right, and that replaced what we call the common law doctrine of riparian rights. Most of California is prior appropriation, but there's parts of it where there's still some common law riparian rights. But prior appropriation is useful because it does establish fairly clearly who owns the water. You have the water, it's usually first in time, first in right. If you were the first person to use it, you have a right to a certain amount of it, and the amount is usually specified. But that makes a pretty clear right. Unfortunately, those rights have been attenuated in the present sort of a situation, and there's lots of things that keep water from being transferred.
Ooh, okay. This is beautifully complicated, Mr. Hill, and I like it. I don't want to be rushed for time. Can you stick around for a segment here? We'll take a break.
Sure.
I want to really spell this out. I want to get a good California water history, and I have a feeling, and you can we'll get this right or not, that does the original way that we did it make sense today, yes or no?
Well, it makes sense, but we have to refine it some ways, and we particularly have to make transferring water easier. That's okay. The biggest problem.
Okay, we'll get that coming up next. 1-800-760-KFMB, Mike Slater Show. Spread the word. Slater Crusaders, getting back to the beginnings of water. Not Genesis 1, but beginning of water here in California with Peter Hill. Peter, thank you for sticking around. All right, talk down to us for a second here. Let's talk about the difference between the doctrine of prior appropriation and riparian rights. What are the difference between those two things?
The main thing is that prior appropriation basically allows you to divert water for particular purposes. And, of course, that started in mining, but then becomes tremendously important for agriculture. And this is mostly in the West. In the East, the riparian doctrine that said you had rights to water if your land was next to the water, but basically it was maybe to water your cow or to do a few sorts of things like that. But it's in the arid West where it really becomes important to divert water for other uses. And it was first diverted for mining, and then it was diverted for agriculture. And that's why the people on the ground developed a particular system of rights that said if you're the first one to divert it, and you can show how much you've diverted it, and you've put it to beneficial use, then you have a property right in that water. And that's useful because as we think about adjusting to changing conditions, which is what California is really all about right now, having a system of property rights and the ability to transfer those property rights is what allows you to adjust to change.
Is this doctrine of prior appropriation, is this what causes some farmers who were there first to use perhaps more water than they otherwise would need to because they have first claim to it?
Well, they have first claim to it, and they might use more than what they otherwise would. But again, if it's marketable and under the original prior appropriation doctrine, you could transfer it to somebody else. And so if another farmer downstream could put it to a higher use or a local municipality could use it, then the farmer would say, look, I can don't have to use all of it. Most of the time when we talk about changing uses, we think we're going to change it from one use to another use. If there were markets for water, complete water markets in California, there wouldn't be as much water used in agriculture, but there would still be a certain amount used because it's kind of on the edge or the margin that we make those sorts of adjustments. So my answer would be no, a person will not waste water in the sense they don't waste other resources if those resources are marketable.
Well, I want to get to that marketable part real quick. But so I guess to wrap that up, do you think this system does it have inefficiencies?
Well, it has inefficiencies if there are what we would call high transaction costs to moving the resource around. Hmm. And prior appropriation, as it developed, worked pretty well for a period of time. We haven't modified it in certain ways that would make it work better. But basically, or fundamentally, having rights to resources that people know what they are, they're pretty well defined, and then they can transfer them, eliminates most of the inefficiencies.
So transfer would be one farmer has it and then transfer it to another farmer down the road.
Transfer to another farmer, although, you know, in California, the big change over the last 70 or 80 years is more urbanization. So water is probably more valuable on the margin, on the edge of the use, in certain municipal uses than it is in agriculture. But the farmers should be allowed to transfer it, and they should be allowed to get the gain that would come from transferring it.
And the people who have the ability to do that are the people who have been there the longest.
That's the way the prior appropriation system works. But they've been there the longest, but they only have a right to a certain amount of water. You know, it's first in time, first in use. And so they would be the ones that would have the right, but they don't have the right to all of the water. It depends on how much they established their right to and when they established it.
So you've used this term before, like marketing water, making water marketable. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Basically, it means you can transfer the rights. That an irrigation district or a farmer can transfer it to a city. We first start out by thinking about just transferring it to other farmers. But then over time, it becomes clear that some very high water use crops don't make sense. It doesn't make sense to use them for that. For instance, almonds take a huge amount of water to raise them. The farmer can make a decision that he would prefer to put in a crop that doesn't use as much water because the water would be more valuable, for instance, for people to drink in the city or to water their lawns, all of their sorts of things. But it's all about people making their own decisions about what's the best use of the resource, and that's where markets really come in. You don't have to tell people they have to quit using something. or that they would be better off using another resource. You use prices to communicate that information.
Okay, that's interesting. So if a farmer right now is growing almonds, which, as you said, uses a ton of water. We talked about alfalfa yesterday or 2 days ago. Same thing. So if they decide, if they have control over their water, and they say, well, if we grow avocados, that requires a tenth of the water. Now we have 90% of our prior water usage. I'm going to sell that to the city of Los Angeles.
Right.
Why does that
make sense? Yeah.
Yeah. So because there's a shortage, and whenever there's a shortage, you can always trace it back to some government involvement. So why does that logical system not happen?
Doesn't happen because we put all sorts of restrictions on transfers. Water that comes to farmers from the Bureau of Reclamation oftentimes carries with it a rule that you can't transfer it away from agriculture. That's not in every case, and in some cases in California, they've been able to get around that, but that puts a very high cost on transferring it. The rules have also been expanded to say that lots of people can object to any sort of water transfer. There's a no-injury rule in California law that says that if there's a water transfer, it can't injure the local economy. That's an ambiguous enough rule that people can go to the courts and they can sue for almost any water transfer. And, of course, environmental rights, or what we would call amenity uses, are more important. That's a very natural thing to happen as we've gotten wealthier. But the way that we've kind of put into practice the environmental rights has been mostly by judicial action, by people being able to sue and stop transactions rather than trying to enhance the market, say, for in-stream flows of water or for environmental rights where either people or local governments can go in and just purchase those for those uses.
Okay, this is interesting. So can you make up an analogy or make up a situation where a farmer would want to sell, but a neighboring farm, because of the no injury rule, says, hold on, no, you can't transfer your water?
Well, it could be the neighboring farm, but it might also be the people who live in the local area who say that our economy is going to be harmed. The local farmer has, say, if there's a return flow, and his rights might be impacted by the farmer selling some of his rights. That's a clearer sort of a case that part of the problem is you get water out and you irrigate, but part of it goes back in. Mm-hmm. And so the farmer downstream probably should have the right to say that, you know, some of that return flow really belongs to me. That's not the real problematic case. The problematic case is when anybody outside of, say, the farming of the farmers themselves can sue because they say they're going to be injured. And in some sense, they will. But there's the dynamism of economies.
Yeah.
You have to have the rights pretty well clarified and defined. And to say that what we are called, you know, third-party effects, that, say, the implement dealer in the city or people that like to come there and vacation because they like to look at the water and now they're going to be injured because there won't be as much water in the stream, those are pretty well undefined rights. And it's very hard to figure out then who has those sorts of rights. And what you do is you create just a judicial backlog or a huge mess in terms of anybody can sue to kind of claim anything, and then the court has to sort it out, and that really makes the sorts of transfers that California needs to have very difficult.
Fascinating. So because a farmer can't transfer water, they're sort of, I don't want to say stuck with it, but like they have it, might as well use it. All right, well, I guess we're going to grow almonds when it doesn't really make sense for us to grow almonds in California.
Right, yeah. In many parts of California, and I don't know particularly about, you know, particular crops, but in many parts of California, water is worth to the farmer between $50 and $100 an acre foot. And that's an acre foot of water, so enough water to cover an acre 1 foot deep. That's a lot of water. And it's worth something to the farmer. In many of your municipalities, it's worth at least $1,000, and in some cases, it's worth $8,000 or $10,000 an acre foot. In those sorts of cases, it makes sense for the farmer to be able to say, I'll cut back on my production. I may even fallow my fields, but I can get much more benefit by transferring my water to other sorts of uses.
What? Peter, how come I've never heard of this in my entire life? So a farmer, the value of the water that they have, that they use, is $50 an acre foot?
In many cases, it is.
Mm-hmm. So that we'll say that's on the lower end, maybe, or is that sort of an average?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so lower end, 50, let's say $100. You're telling me, like, in L.A. or San Diego, the value is what?
probably between, I haven't looked at the latest data, sure. I know it's worth at least $1,000 an acre foot.
Well, come on. So it would make way more sense to sell the water than it would to grow the crop.
Right, right. In almost every market, if you have that sort of, you know, any other situation you can think of where you have that sort of a differential, you know, if I have my my Honda 2003 CRV and it's worth $3,000 to me and it's worth $9,000 to somebody else, you can bet it's going to be transferred. The person's going to place much more in value for it, and it makes sense to transfer it. But in water, there are just all sorts of restrictions that keep that from happening.
Now, are there technological restrictions?
There may be technological restrictions that stand in the way of it. Water is difficult to transport over long distances. California has a fair amount of infrastructure that does that. So that can be... That's not one of what we would call kind of the artificial transaction cost. That's a real cost of moving it around, and it makes it more difficult to move it. So that's a real cost, and we can do some technological changes that will help there. That's not the biggest issue. The biggest issue is just restrictions on markets.
Well, that's what Prop 1 should have done. The $7.1 billion that we spent, that should have done to make those technological transfers easier.
Right.
But, of course, that wasn't... part of it. So this has been done before in America, transferring water across lines?
Sure. Yeah, it's been moved in a lot of cases. In fact, in many states, we now have the ability for people to purchase water to leave it in streams. When we first started thinking about water, you know, people didn't think that would be high value for what we would call in-stream use for fishing or viewing or just recreating. It turns out as we've gotten wealthier, people place more value on that. Science has changed also, and people say, well, there's some real value in having the water in the streams. In several states now, people can actually purchase the right, or groups, say Trout Unlimited or some water trust, can purchase the right to leave the water in the stream. That's a willing transfer. The farmer says, yeah, I'll give up some of my water. It particularly turns out to be important in many western states in late season when water flows are low and there's danger to fish, to fish habitat, those sorts of things. And so, again, the farmer ordinarily doesn't give up all of his water, but he might give up the right to irrigate his second or his third cutting of alfalfa. And for him, he says, yeah, I can give up, some of my hay crop, and the fishermen say, yeah, we'd like to have the water in the stream. So they organize and they purchase the water, and it turns out to be like any other sort of a market transaction.
Oh, this is so frustrating. I know you've been screaming this from the rooftops for a long time, Mr. Hill. Can we do the same thing? What percentage of the solution do you think this is, it making it easier to transfer water?
Well, I think it's 80 to 90% of the solution.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, or maybe it's all of the solution. Now, you have a real problem, of course, in that you have a major drought. But I've spent most of my life running cattle ranches and family cattle ranches, and we had to make all sorts of adjustments in droughts. And we did them because there were pretty well-defined rights to the land, to our cattle, and we could make sort of adjustments that were appropriate. And California's going to have to go through some adjustments. It's just that you're doing it in a pretty awkward, very costly way, by just kind of universal mandates that say you have to cut back by 25%, you have to quit using water in particular uses. Allowing people to make their own decisions when they're faced with the costs really is the way to solve problems where we have a change of circumstances. And you're undergoing a major change in circumstances. You need to reallocate resources. But thinking of property rights and markets is the way to get those reallocations done with the least cost and with allowing everybody to have a vote, and they vote through the market price system.
I have to run 30 seconds. Would you say we're looking right now in Venezuela with a ton of shortages and so many different things, toilet paper, milk, et cetera, et cetera. Same thing, right? We're having a shortage here. What we say, a drought is caused by nature, but a water shortage is caused by government, right? We have government mandates and laws and whatnot, and here we have a shortage. We shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, that's right on.
So, sorry, again, real quick, how do we eliminate those, what you call them, no injury laws? Is that what that is?
Well, we have to be clearer about about who can sue and what the aspects, what the injuries are. So we have to just basically allow more transfers. We probably have to better define some of the rights that a farmer has in issues like return flow, how much of the water does he use up and how much of it does it flow back into the stream. That needs to be defined more carefully. And then we have to clarify the rules about who can sue. And we've made it so what we would think of as just a vast array of parties can enter into any sort of a lawsuit. Part of this is another legal doctrine called the public trust doctrine that says the government has should be holding the rights for the public. And when you get to that area, then you've opened it up for almost anybody to sue over almost any cause.
Yep, that's California. Peter Hill, I'm blown away, sir. I knew I would be talking with you. Can we talk again in more detail, perhaps, and expand this conversation later?
Certainly.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it very much. Peter Hill there from PERC, PERC.com or org. Just Google it. It's great. .org. PERC.org. Fantastic organization. Environmentalists and free marketeers. Love it. Mike Slater Show. Spread the word. I loved that conversation. And this song. You can be sure that whenever there is a shortage of anything, toilet paper in Venezuela, milk in Cuba, gasoline in different parts of the world, and water here in California, if there's a shortage in anything, government is involved somewhere in the market, screwing it up. No different with water. As we say all the time, drought caused by nature, water shortage caused by government. Coming up next, we're going to talk to another rancher, get his take, and any minute now, they're going to announce the verdict in the Boston Bomber trial, and we will go there live when that happens. Bottom line of water, don't let anyone tell you that these cuts are necessary. They're not. It's all caused by government, and there's free market solutions.